From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. The Last Man by C. Barry Quinn. Mycroft paused self-consciously before the little bronze plate marked simply Toussaint, above the doorbell of the big brown stone house in East 136th Street. He felt extraordinarily foolish, like a costumed adult at a child's masquerade party, or as if he were about to rise and speak a piece. People, his kind of people, simply didn't do this sort of thing. Then his resolution hardened. "What can I lose?" he muttered cynically, and pressed the button. A butler, correct as a St. John's Wood functionary, in a silver button dress suit and striped waistcoat, answered his ring. "Mr. Monsieur Toussaint?" asked Mycroft tentatively. "Who is calling?" asked the butler, with the merest trace of accent on his words. "Mr. Smith, no, Jones," Mycroft replied, and a shadow of a sneer showed at the corner of the young butler's mouth. "One minute, if you please," he returned, stepped back into the hall and closed the door. In a moment he was back and held the door open. "This way, if you please," he invited. Mycroft was not quite certain what he would find. What he did find amazed him. Vaguely he had thought the place would reek with incense, possibly be hung with matricious tapestries and papier-mâché weapons, perhaps display a crystal ball or two against the cheap cotton velvet table covers. He was almost awestruck by the somber magnificence of the room into which he was ushered. Deep-piled rugs from Hamadan and Samarkand lay on the floor. The furniture was obviously French, dull matte-colored wood, upholstered in olive-green brocade. On the walls were either Renoir and Picasso originals or imitations good enough to fool a connoisseur. Somewhat incongruously, above the fireplace, where logs blazed on polished andirons, hung a square of rather crudely woven cotton stuff bordered in barbaric black and green. On second look, the border proved to be highly conventionalized, but still disturbingly realistic serpent. More in character was the enormous black Persian cat that crouched upon a lustrous Bokhara prayer rug before the fire, paws tucked demurely under it, great plumy tail curled around it, and stared at him with yellow, sulphurous eyes. "Good evening, Mr. Mycroft. You wish to see me?" Mycroft started, as if he hadn't been stung by a wasp. He had not heard the speaker enter, and certainly he was not prepared to be greeted by name. At the entrance of the drawing room stood his host, smiling faintly at his discomfiture. He was a tall man of uncertain age, dressed with a beautiful attention to detail and faultless evening clothes. The studs of his immaculate white shirt were star sapphires, so were his cufflinks, and his lapel showed the red ribbon of the Legion d'Honneur, and he was very distinct looking. But not comic, not dressed up, nor out of character. He wore his English tailored dress clothes as one to the manner born, and there was distinction, almost a nobility, about his features that made Mycroft think of the head of an old Roman emperor, or perhaps a statesman of the golden age of the Republic, carved in basalt. He had planned his introduction, humorous and a little patronizing, but as he stared at the other, Mycroft fell stage silent. "Ah," he began, then gulped and stumbled in speech. I've heard about you, Mr. Monsieur Toussaint. Some friends of mine told me." "Yes," prompted Toussaint, as Mycroft's voice frayed out like a pulled woolen thread. "What is it that you want of me? I've heard you're able to do remarkable things." Once more he halted, and a look of irritation crossed his host's calm features. "Really, Mr. Mycroft?" "I've heard that you have power to raise spirits," Mycroft blurted confusedly. "I'm told you can bring spirits of the dead back." Once again he halted, angry with himself, for the fear he felt clawing at his throat. "Can it be done? Can you do it?" "Of course," Toussaint replied, quite as if he had been asked if he could furnish musicians for a party. "Whose spirit is it that you want called? When and how did he die?" Mycroft felt on sure ground now. There was no nonsense about this Toussaint, no hint of the charlatan. He was a businessman discussing business. "There are several of them, 25 or 6. They died in different ways. You see, they served with me in." "Very well, Mr. Mycroft. Come here tonight at precisely 11:50. Everything will be in readiness, and you must on no account be late. Leave your telephone and address with the butler in case I have to get in touch with you." "And the fee?" "The fee will be $500, payable after the seance, if you're satisfied. Otherwise, there will be no charge. Good evening, Mr. Mycroft." The impulse had come to him that evening as he walked across the park from his apartment to his club in East 86th Street. Spring had come to New York, delicately as a ballerina dancing sur le pont. Every tree was veiled in scarves of green chiffon. Every park was jeweled with crocus gold. But he had found no comfort in awakening nature, nor any joy in the sweet softness of the air. That morning, as he unfurled his Times in the subway on his way downtown, he had seen the notice of Roy Hardy's death. Roy had been the 26th. He was the last man. More than 50 years ago, they had marched down the avenue, eager, bright-faced, colors flying, curbside crowds cheering, off to Cuba, off to fight for liberty. Remember the Maine. When you hear that bell go ding-a-ling, and we all join in and sweetly we will sing, my baby. When you hear that bell go ding-a-ling, there'll be a hot time in the old town tonight. The band had blared. He could still hear the echo of Max Schultz's cornet as he triple-tongued the final note. They didn't look too much like soldiers, those ribbon counter clerks and bookkeepers and stock exchange messengers, the supercilious French and British correspondents and observers smiled tolerantly at their efforts to seem military. The Germans laughed outright, and the German-armed, German-trained Spanish veterans disdained them. But after El Caney and San Juan Hill, the tune changed. Astounded and demoralized, the Spaniards surrendered in droves. The foreigners became polite. The Cubans took the valiant Americans to their collective hearts, and no one was more gracious in his hospitality than Don José Rosales y Montalvo, whose house in the Calle O'Brien became an informal headquarters for the officers and non-coms of the company. Don José's table creaked and groaned beneath a load of delicacies, such as those young New Yorkers had never seen or even heard of, and his cellars seemed inexhaustible. Lads who had known only beer, or in more reckless moments, gin and whiskey, were introduced to Saint-Estèphe, Johannesburg, and Nuit Saint-Georges. Madeira and Mallorca flowed like water. Champagne was common as soda pop at home. But more intoxicating than the strongest, headiest vintage in Don José's caves was Doña Juanita María, his daughter. She was a rubia, a Spanish blonde, with hair as lustrous as the fine-drawn wires of the gold filigrees across her throat. Little, tiny, she walked with a sort of lilting, questing eagerness, her every movement graceful as a grain stalk in the wind. Her voice had that sweet, throaty, velvety quality found only in southern countries, and when she played the guitar and sang canciones, the songs were fraught with yearning sadness and passionate longing that made those hearing her catch their breath. Every man jack of them was in love with her, and not a one of them but polished up his Spanish to say, "Yo te amo, Juanita. Juanita, I love you." And there was not a one of them who did not get a sweet, tender refusal, and by way of consolation, a chaste sisterly kiss on the cheek. The night before the transport sailed, Don Jose gave a party, a celebración grande. The patio of the house was almost bright as noon with moonlight, and in the narrow Saracen arches between the pillars of the ambulatory Chinese lanterns hung, glowing golden yellow in the shadows. A long table clothed with fine Madeira, drawn work and shining silver and crystal, was laid in the center of the courtyard. At its center was a great bouquet of red roses. Wreathed in roses, a fat wine cask stood on wooden sawhorses near the table's head. "It is Pedro Eximinis, a full 100 years old," Don Jose explained pridefully. "I have kept it for some great occasion. Surely this is one. What greater honor could it have been than to have served to Cuba's gallant liberators on the eve of their departure?" After dinner, toasts were drunk to Cuba Libre, to Don Jose, to the lovely Doña Juanita. Then, blushing very prettily but in no see disconcerted, she consented to sing a farewell. "Pregúntales a las estrellas si no de noche me ven llorar. Pregúntales si no busco para adorarte la soledad." She sang, "Oh, ask of the stars above you if I did not weep all the night. Oh, ask if I do not love you. Who of you dreamt till the dawn light?" Sabers flashed in the moonlight, blades beat upon the table. "Juanita, Juanita," they cried fervently. "We love you, Juanita. And I love you, all of you. Señoras amados," she called back gaily. "Each one of you I love so much, I could not bear to give my heart to him for fear of hurting all the others." So, her throaty, velvety voice was like a caress. "Here is what I promise." Her tone shrank to a soft, ingratiating pizzicato, and her words were delicately spaced, so that they shone like minted silver as she spoke them. "I shall belong to the last one of you. Surely one of you will outlive all the rest. And to him I shall give my heart, myself, all of me. I swear it." She put both tiny hands against her lips and blew them a collective kiss. And so, because they were all very young and very much in love, and also slightly drunk, they formed the Last Man Club. And every year upon the anniversary of that night they met, talked over old times, drank a little more than was good for them, and dispersed to meet again next year. The years slipped by unnoticed as the current of a placid river, and time was good to them. Some of them made names for themselves in finance. The courtrooms echoed to the oratory of others. The First World War brought rank and glory to home. More than one nationally advertised product bore the name of one of their number. But time took his fee also. Each time there were more vacant chairs about the table when they met, and those who remained showed gray at the temples, thickening at the waist, or shining patches of bald scalp. Last year there had been only three of them, Mycroft, Rice, and Hardy. 2 months ago he and Hardy had acted as pallbearers for Rice. Now Hardy was gone. He hardly knew what made him decide to consult Toussaint. The day before, he'd met Dick Pryor at luncheon at the India House, and somehow talk had turned on mediums and spiritism. "I think there are a lot of fakes," Mycroft had said, but Pryor shook his head in disagreement. Some of them, most probably, are. But there are some things hard to explain, Roger. Take this Toussaint. He may be a faker, but what about him? Well, it seems he came from Haiti. There's a legend he descended from Christophe. I wouldn't know about that, or whether what they say about us having been a papalois, a voodoo priest, you know, has any basis. He's highly educated, a graduate of Lima and the Sorbonne and all of that. His ancestors were some of the French that settled there on Haiti. What's he done? Mycroft demanded testily. You say he's done remarkable things. He has. Remember old man Maison, noble Maison, and the way his first wife made a monkey out of her successor? Mycroft shook his head. Not very well. I recall there was a will contest. I'll say there was. Old Maison got bit by the love bug sometime after 60. Huh. Love bug me I. It was that little gold digger, Suzanne Langdon. The way she took him away from his wife was nothing less than petty larceny. He didn't last long after he divorced Dorothy and married Suzanne. Old men who marry young wives seldom do. When he finally pegged out, everybody thought he was intestate, and that meant Mrs. Maison, number two, would take the jackpot. But just as she was all set to take in the chips, Dorothy came up with a last will and testament, signed, sealed, published, and declared, and unassailable as Gibraltar. Seems the old goof got wise to himself, and what was more to the point, to Suzanne, before he kicked the bucket and made a will that disinherited her, leaving the whole works to Dorothy. They found it in the pocket of an old coat in his shooting cabin out on the island, and found the men who'd witness it, a Long Island clam digger and a garage mechanic out at Smithtown. How? Asked Mycroft. Through this fellow Toussaint. Dorothy had heard of him somehow. I went up to Harlem to consult him. She told my Aunt Matilda, Mrs. Truxton Sturdivant, you know, all about it. Seems Toussaint called old Maison spook up, or maybe down, I wouldn't know. And it told him all about the will. Gave him minute directions where to look for it. Told him who and where the witnesses were. He charged her a stiff fee, but he delivered. She's satisfied. Mycroft had dismissed the story from his mind that afternoon. But next day, when he read Royce Hardy's death notice, it recurred to him. That evening, as he walked across the park, he reached a decision. Of course, it was all nonsense. But Pryor's story stuck in his mind like a burr in a dog's fur. Oh well. He'd have to go at this Toussaint. Nothing more. It would be amusing to see him go through his bag of tricks. The furniture and rugs had been moved from the drawing room when he reached Toussaint's house, 10 minutes before 12. Before the empty cold fireplace, a kind of altar had been set up, cloth with a fair cloth and surmounted by a silver cross, like any chapel sanctuary. But there were other things on it. Before the cross, there coiled a great black snake. Whether stuffed or carved from black wood, he could not determine. On each side of the coiling serpent was a gleaming human skull. Tall candles flickered at each end of the altar, giving off the only light in the room. As his eyes became accustomed to the semi-darkness, he saw that a hexagonal design had been drawn on the bare floor in red chalk, enclosing the altar, and a spare some 8 feet square each side, and in each of the 6 angles of the figure stood a little dish filled with black powder. Before the altar, at the very center of the hexagon, was placed a folding chair of the kind used in funeral parlors. Annoyed, he looked about the room for some sign of Toussaint, and as the big clock in the hall struck the first day of its half-hour chime, a footstep sounded at the door. Toussaint entered with an attendant at each elbow. All three wore cassocks of bright scarlet, and over these were surplices of white linen. In addition, each wore a red pointed cap like a mitre on his head. "Be seated," Toussaint whispered, pointed to the folding chair before the altar and speaking quickly, as if great haste were necessary. "On no account, no matter what you see or hear, are you to put so much as a finger past the confines of the hexagon. If you do, you are worse than a dead man. You are lost. You understand?" Mycroft nodded, and Toussaint approached the altar with his attendants close beside him. They did not genuflect, merely bowed deeply. Then Toussaint took two candles from beneath his surplice, lit them at the tapers burning on the altar, and handed them to his attendants. Fairly running from one point of the hexagon to another, the acolytes set fire to the black powder in the little metal saucers with their candles, then rejoined Toussaint at the altar. The big hall clock had just completed striking 12 as Toussaint called out sharply, "Papa Legba, keeper of the gate, open for us." Like a congregation making the response of a litany, the acolytes repeated, "Papa Legba, keeper of the gate, open for us. Papa Legba, open wide the gate that they may pass," intoned Toussaint, and once again his attendants repeated his invocation. It might have been the rumble of a subway train, or one of those strange inexplicable noises that the big city knows at night, but Mycroft could have sworn that he heard the rumble of distant thunder. Again and again Toussaint repeated his petition that the gate be opened, and his dance echoed it. This was getting to be tiresome. Mycroft shifted on his uncomfortable seat and looked across his shoulder. His heart contracted suddenly, and the blood churned in his ears. About the chalk-marked hexagon there seemed to cluster, in the smoke cast off by the centers, a rack of dim, indistinct forms, forms not quite human, yet resembling nothing else. They did not move. They did not stir as fog stirs in a breath of wind. They simply hung there motionless in the still air. Papa Legba opened wide the gate that those this man would speak with may come through, shouted Toussaint. And now the silent shadow form seemed taking on a kind of substance. Mycroft could distinguish features. Willis Dykes. He'd been the top kick. And Freddie Pyle, the shave tail. Curtis Sackett, Ernie Proust, one after another of his old comrades he saw in the silent circle, as a man sees images upon a photographic negative when he holds it up to the light. Now Toussaint's chant had changed. No longer was it reiterated Pika, but a great shout of victory. Dambala Kero, master of the heavens, Dambala, thou art here. Open wide the dead ones' mouths. Dambala Oero, give them breath to speak and answer questions. Give this one his heart's desire. Turning from the altar, he told Mycroft, say what you have to say quickly. The power will not last long. Mycroft shook himself like a dog emerging from the water. For an instant, he saw in his mind's eye the courtyard of Don Jose's house, saw the eager, flushed-faced youths grouped about the table, saw Juanita in the silver glow of moonlight, lovely as a fairy from Titania's court, as she laughed at them, promising. Juanita, where is Juanita? He asked thickly. She promised she would give herself to the last man. Estoy aquí, querido. In 50 years and more, he had not heard that voice, but he remembered it as if it had been yesterday, or 10 minutes since, when he last heard it. Juanita, he breathed, and the breath choked in his throat as he pronounced her name. She came towards him, quickly, passing through the ranks of misty shades like one who walks through swirling whirls of silvery fog. Both her hands reached toward him in a pretty haste. All in white she was, from the great carved ivory comb in her golden hair to the little white sandals cross-strapped over her silken insteps. Her white mantilla had been drawn across her face coquettishly, but he could see it flutter with a breath of her impatience. Roger, She spoke his name with the same hesitation between syllables he remembered so well. Roger, querido, beloved. He leaped from the chair, stretched, reaching hands for her outstretched gloved fingers past the boundary of the chalk-drawn hexagon. Juanita, Juanita, I have waited so long, so long. Her mantilla fell back as his fingers almost touched hers. There was something wrong with her face. This was not the image he had carried in his heart for more than 50 years. Beneath the crown of gleaming golden hair, between the folds of the white lace mantilla, a bare, fleshless skull looked at him. Empty eye holes stared into his eyes. Lipless teeth grinned at him. He stumbled like a man hit with a blackjack, spun halfway round, then went down so quickly that the impact of his limpness on the polished floor made the candles on the altar flicker. Maitre, one of the attendants plucked Toussaint's white surplice. Maitre, the man is dead.